Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Brotherless Night.
And I'm Whitney Terrell, author of the novel The Good Lieutenant. And before we get started on this, which is going to be a very super depressing Sugi episode, I have a bit of good news.
Your students came up with this episode.
Oh, well, okay, TBD. True. You're going to love it, though. How depressing it is. But do you know what? This is coming out on May 11th. You know what day this is?
What day is May 11th?
It is my son, Morrison, a.k.a. Moss Terrell's 18th birthday.
No.
He is all grown up. He has finished all but the shouting. High school, he's done a great job. He studied hard. He's going to go to NYU. I'm super proud of him. I just wanted to shout out a happy birthday to my son.
Well, happy birthday, Moss. I remember when you were 12 and we started this podcast.
I know. Can you believe that? He was 12 years old.
He was a little baby.
That's insane. Oh, my God.
Well, we have to have a better world for his generation, I think. And now I am segueing smoothly into this depressing topic that your students came up with. And it's true. I'm totally fascinated by it. So like a few months ago, you and I were talking about East Palestine with your students. So for our listeners who might not be familiar with this, this is the incident a few months ago where a train carrying 100,000 gallons of hazardous chemicals derailed in East Palestine, Ohio, and residents of the town had to evacuate, and emergency responders decided to burn the train's chemical cargo intentionally.
Brilliant idea.
To avoid the risk of a larger explosion.
Yeah, well, okay. Maybe that was, I guess, but there's this problem with burning toxic chemicals like vinyl chloride is that it produces a class of toxins called dioxin. And dioxin is carcinogenic. And now there are major concerns about continued environmental contamination in that area.
So had you heard of dioxin before we started working on this episode? Because I felt like I should have, but I definitely had not.
It was like hearing an old song that you hadn't heard for a long time, like by the Cars or something. Like when I was much younger in 1983, there was this Superfund site in Times Beach, Missouri, because in years before that they had been spraying the roads with this oil that had dioxin in it, you know, and the whole town, you know, basically had to be abandoned. So I did once we started doing the research for this and reading. And talking to the author that we're going to talk to, remember that. But I had not thought about dioxin in a very long time.
Well, holy shit, is what happened in Times Beach, is that what's going to happen in East Palestine? What does this kind of toxic exposure do to a community in the long term?
It is not good. But to get the exact answer, we're going to talk to the writer Carrie Arsenault, who's got all the information that we need to know.
Carrie Arsenault is a literary critic, co-director of the Environmental Storytelling Studio at Brown University, contributing editor at Orion Magazine, Democracy Fellow at the Charles Warren Center for Studies in American History at Harvard, and author of Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains, which won the Rachel Carson Environment Book Award from the Society of Environmental Journalists and the Maine Literary Award for Nonfiction. Was also a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Leonard Prize for Best First Book in Any Genre. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me and reaching out.
Thanks for being here. In your book, Milltown, which I really think is an important book, you return to your hometown of Mexico, Maine. And just before we get talking about the problems there, and which is the book is about, what was it like growing up there? Before you learned about the very complicated relationship that the town had with the local paper mill?
You know, I'm super glad you asked that because I think it's important to know what there is to lose before you read about loss, especially with environmental loss. And as such, it was a great place to grow up. I mean, it was like gangs of kids running around playing in people's backyards and swimming in the river and skiing. And we lived outside, basically. Our mothers stayed home until at least the 80s. Our fathers went to work and everything was pretty stable. It was great. I had a great childhood.
So you moved away, you came back, and a character in the book, a person in the book whose conversations with you kind of helped to bring you home is a woman named Terry Martin. And she was married to a man named Edward Martin, whose nickname was Doc. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about how your conversations with Terry kind of brought you back to Mexico and how you learned from them about the pollution that led to the town of Mexico earning the nickname Cancer Valley.
I actually think Doc Martin came up with that nickname and then it got repeated in a Boston News program. But the nickname, we joked about it all the time growing up. So even though I had this great childhood, we'd be like, oh, we live in Cancer Valley. And when I started to do genealogy research in the beginning of working on this book, I went to Terry because she and her husband were led the Acadian Society, which is what my ancestry is from. So I went to her and then she's like, you can't write about your family without writing about disease. And I was like, what do you mean? And she put it this way. Basically, she's like, your family history is tied directly to the environmental history of the United States. And here's why. You know, she was a nurse too. And she and Doc Martin had seen all these cancers, the diagnosis of cancers in our town increasing over the years, and all kinds of strange cancers too. And Doc Martin started to try to get people to care. Leaders, the mill, the Maine DEP, that's the Department of Environmental Protection, the EPA, tried to warn people. But basically he was silenced in a few ways that I talk about in the book. And then Harry took up the cause later, starting a bucket brigade of literally trying to catch air and sending it off to labs, which I think is the most futile exercise I've ever heard. But and then she did a door-to-door survey, a house study she called it. She went door-to-door, knocked on people's doors in a neighborhood where my grandparents lived, and found stunning unofficial cancer results from those house studies. Anyway, that's kind of where we started.
I thought those scenes were really heartbreaking, because you have the sense of like how little chance she has of getting this to anyone to pay attention to, or the lack of resources. She doesn't have any scientific, you know, apparatus to sort of do what she's trying to do. She's just hand making these studies.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the futility. That's why I say like catching air just seems like, it's like a metaphor for this whole book. And it's like both in her trying to get something done and in me trying to find information. It was like trying to capture air in a bucket.
When I look at these news stories about the people living in East Palestine, who we talked about at the top of the show, and they're talking about like, well, so-and-so felt sick and this is happening. And like, I feel like they're going through the exact same process of like feeling something's wrong, not having the tools to check on it, not trusting the government to check on it for them. I wonder if you felt similarities there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. When the danger of dioxin, which is the thing that was released in burning vinyl chloride in Palestine, and the thing that's released when you, it's a byproduct really, that's created when you bleach white paper, which is the same thing, what happens in my town. So dioxin, we're talking about dioxin. So there's a lot of problems with it health-wise, but the sociological and the mental problems are something that people are not talking enough about. Like when people in communities like mine or Palestine are told by leaders or companies or lawyers that, you know, they're told misleading information, like local cancers are within a normal range. They aren't. Risks can be controlled. They can't. That industry or government is not to blame, and they usually are. And people can develop PTSD, actually, or non-empirical belief systems, because the bodily facts that they develop don't add up. The bodily facts they experience don't add up what they're told. So I'm glad you pointed that out, because it's a constant problem in any of these kind of environmental disasters. It's the same old story, you know?
It's fascinating because, it's really like the gaslighting of an entire town. And they have to insist on telling their story repeatedly. I was reading that CDC investigators who were at the site, 7 of them got sick. It just seems like yeah, the story that the EPA tells about itself as not responsible, you know, we didn't know that the chemicals were going to be burned. No one checked with us. You know, this, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is the same story and over. A toxic event happens, the media rushes to it to flurry, activists get involved, the government acts concerned, and nothing ever really happens. That's the story, right? And then we forget about it in the media. You know, it's not on the front page. There's other new things and spectacles happening. But I don't know, blaming the EPA or blaming anybody, I've been thinking about this idea of blame. You know, we all want to hold somebody accountable or responsible, but I'm not sure that's the solution either. I'm not even sure the EPA is to blame. I mean, who is to blame? I think it goes down to, you know, maybe crafting regulations that keep our country safer, that keep communities safer, that keep all of us safer, you know, from toxic chemicals. Like in Europe, most of their chemicals that are created, they have this thing called a precautionary principle, but these companies have to prove the chemicals are safe. In the US, the burden is put on us, like citizens. We have to prove they're dangerous. It's a little whack-a-mole system we have going on.
I mean, we're going to talk a little bit more about regulation. Regulation is like, I mean, we have a party that is explicitly against all kinds of regulation, and there's a long mantra in America that regulation is bad. And I teach many, many essays about how regulation is what's good. And when regulation goes away, you have terrible disasters. But anyway, but the one thing, the other reason we brought you here is to talk a little bit about the history of dioxin, because you write not just about what happened in your town, but like how off frequently this has happened. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the history of dioxin poisonings in America and what makes dioxin so dangerous.
Yeah, let me quickly start. I'll try to explain why dioxin is so dangerous. It's
the generic. And by the way, I'm sorry, I should have said this at first, is that the concern is that in East Palestine, there is dioxin, that the combination of the chemicals, the burning has released dioxin, and that is why we're focusing on that chemical.
Yeah, no, it's a generic term for a group of about 75 related chemical compounds, and they're produced unintentionally. So they're always a byproduct of something. They're never a thing that's produced to do something like a pesticide, right? Like the processing of bleaching paper with chlorine, like I mentioned. And dioxins also were part of what was used in Agent Orange to defoliate the jungle in Vietnam. And that was in what, you know, then there was, that was 1961 to 71-ish. They were using that. So for 10 years, just spraying dioxin on the jungle. Love Canal, 1978. Then there was Times Beach, Missouri, which was 1972 maybe, but that lasted for about 4 years. They were spraying the roads with this to keep the dust down. It was mixed with dioxin and waste oil. And anyway, they just sprayed it. That town, I think, is not livable anymore. And what's interesting is those are like, when I'm saying these are spectacled events, like these are the ones that people get involved in and report on. But there's like tons of other things, like places in my hometown that are a lot more unspecial and unspectacled, not newsworthy, that nobody's reporting on. I mean, even in Maine right now, there's a big class action suit about paper mills had been and waste facility plants have been spreading sludge over farms across Maine, right? And that they contain PFAS. But what they're not talking about is that sludge also contains dioxin. So there's like a slow moving horror film about like the farms in Maine. They also spread them on baseball fields. So there's these kind of big events, but there's also a lot of slow moving, slow events that aren't getting reported on.
I want to just go back for a second too. I was going through this list of this. You have a couple of like moments where you outline this chronology in your book, and you mentioned Times Beach, Missouri, and I kind of glommed onto that because Whitney is in Missouri. And then you also mentioned Seveso, Italy, and I'm currently at a residency in Italy. And I was kind of like, oh my God. And in Times Beach, one of the interesting things was I was trying to like understand how this worked. And Times Beach was abandoned in 1983, but the motor oil thing was going on in 72 to 76, which means that people were living in that town with the dioxin, and it became uninhabitable like 7 years later. And so like this long stretch of time happens where people are living in this place that's not safe at all. And it takes them that long to like do anything.
Yeah, they knew. I mean, they knew it was unsafe by then. I mean, they used it to defoliate jungles. They knew it could cause harm, you know, right, to living things. So,
I mean, that's what's happening in East Palestine right now, aren't they? I mean, these people are saying, like, should we be here? And the government is saying, like, oh, you're fine. And they're like, we don't know, you know? And I just feel like it's so terrifying to watch that happen.
Yeah. I mean, again, it goes back to the, you know, just, I think these kind of incidences honestly can create a lot of our political divide. And I don't mean to get into politics. I'm not a politician. I'm not a dioxin expert or whatever. But when people living in these rural towns are affected by these environmental disasters, right? And like I said, then they feel like they're being lied to by their government. Therefore, they don't trust government. So therefore, they don't want the regulations, Whitney, like you were saying. People don't want regulations because they don't trust the government. And therefore, we end up in this like crazy like circle of like nobody's getting help, you know? Does that make sense?
That makes complete sense. And I mean, so in your book, you write really powerfully about government and industry collaborating to suppress information about the harmfulness of dioxin. I wonder if you could read a passage from your book about that as we're having this conversation. I'd love for our listeners to get that passage from your book.
Okay. Although I had skimmed the EPA's draft assessment on dioxin years ago, trying to sum it up was like trying to sum up the Bible, and trying to understand it was like trying to understand God there, him or herself. It's hard to compute. I searched through the notes on my computer to see what I wrote about that report, and I find an email exchange with Stephen Lester, the science director at the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice, an organization led by Lois Gibbs, an activist who brought public attention to the Love Canal crisis. I'd written to Stephen in 2017, asking if he could school me on the EPA's dioxin assessments, which was his area of expertise. He said to call, however, I dropped the ball. I email again Stephen again today, I think this was 2019, a couple of years later, to see if he can clarify a few things, like why nobody's talking about dioxin when it seems a critical health issue, at least to me. He said there were two studies the EPA released on dioxin. One was the cancer risk assessment released in draft in 2003, and the other was the non-cancer risk assessment released in final form in 2012. I hadn't understood the difference until now. This was a change in the agency's strategy, Stephen said, to exclude the cancer risks from the final EPA dioxin study. That 2012 report only discussed non-cancer risks, such as reproductive and immune problems associated with dioxin exposure. The 2003 draft determined that dioxin was carcinogenic and that the cancer risk was very high. Exposure to any amount of dioxin increased the risks of getting cancer. At the time of the 2012 report, the agency told us and the public in general that it was continuing to work on the cancer risk portion of the assessment, and they were not done, Stephen writes. But since that time, I've been told repeatedly by staff at EPA that the cancer risk portion is on the shelf with no plans by the agency to go back to it. Why, I ask innocently enough, why won't the EPA go back to finish the job and publish that report? Quote, when the EPA ran the dioxin risk numbers for cancer, those numbers came out so high, it would have a significant ramifications, a debilitating economic impact for the entire US economy. What? I hear myself asking him, not quite registering what he's saying. Put it this way, if the EPA used cancer risk rate data to determine how much dioxin would be allowed in food, you wouldn't be able to even buy a McDonald's hamburger. McDonald's specifically, I ask? No, he says, that the threshold for dioxin is so low based on the 2003 cancer risk assessment that almost all meat, fish, and animal byproducts like butter and milk would have dioxin levels that exceed government standards for how much a person, for how much would be allowed in food. Even one simple hamburger could do a person harm. McDonald's is just a handy reference. He reiterates that the EPA doesn't currently list dioxin as a carcinogen. Will the EPA ever publish this data, I ask? Will they ever make these claims? What they did was brilliant, he says. They published the study on non-cancer risks, then walked away. Dioxin is no longer a problem in the public eye because the EPA stopped thinking about it and stopped analyzing it. So everyone thinks the study is done, I say. It seems that way. No one worries about dioxin anymore.
That is not good! Completely alarming. So like the food I'm eating is like, it has dioxin in it all the time, basically.
Yeah, as does your body. I mean, all of us do. We all have it in us to a point where this is what I've been told. Again, I'm not an expert, but we have enough in us to be almost carcinogenic, all of us, because it bioaccumulates. It doesn't go away. And it also is persistent. It's a persistent organic pollutant. So it stays in our bloodstream. It's got an extremely long half-life. And by the time we get rid of that portion that we ingested, we're getting more. So it's constantly, it's like a river of dioxin going into our body.
So like people, I read about the people having plastic in their bodies, right? And I'm like, okay, I can deal with the plastic. But now this, I don't feel good about.
Feel about plastic. Well, it's interesting. Just recently, I want to follow up that with a quick little note that I worked with this high school in Booth Bay, Maine, and they read this book and they were all, kids were like horrified by the same as you. And they were like, what can we do? What can we do? I'm like, I don't know. I'm not an activist. I was like, just write to your governor or write to whoever. So they write and their letter gets sent to Defend Our Health. It's this organization. Their tagline is solutions for a toxic free tomorrow. Do you want to know what she said? Here's what she said. I wrote it down because I want people to know. Her name is Sarah Woodbury. She said, I talked to my boss, blah, blah, blah. He said that the issue of dioxin isn't really actionable now. There was a big nationwide fight back in the day that led to action both in Maine and at the federal level. Those fights got rid of about 95% of the dioxin. What is left isn't of much consequence, so there isn't much to do. I hope that helps. So even
no,
person,
that does not help. I don't.
That sounds like a load of shit.
It's a load of solutions for a toxic-free tomorrow. You're like, here's the thing: even if 99% of the dioxin was gone, there's the 1% is. It's one. It's probably, you know, it's been considered the most toxic human-made. Chemical that there is. So, and it's very harmful in very, very, very undetectable amounts. So, yeah, it's not good. So I don't eat as much meat as I used to.
My God.
Or cheese.
Yeah. So, I mean, this cheese.
Well, it bioaccumulates in the fat of living things. So, meat, but also the byproducts of, like, if cows, so look at it this way, if a cow ingests it and makes butter out of the cow's milk, so it's like 2 degrees away from the cow, it's actually, it can become stronger. That's what I mean when I say bioaccumulate. So like if my mother had it in her, because she was directly in, you know, ingested, I'm just saying, you know, for exaggerated effect, she ingested it. And then she breastfed me and I breastfed my baby. The person most affected would be my baby, would have more. I think that babies now breastfeeding, I think there's like, it's 77 times the amount. Yeah, here it is. At the top of the food chain is human babies whose breastfeeding mothers can expose nursing infants to dioxin levels 77 times higher than the EPA recommends.
The rest of this episode is just going to be me screaming.
Just put on the white noise sound and the video shut down.
I mean, white Holy noise. Let's talk shit. About that. Let's talk about White Noise by Don DeLillo. It's a toxic airborne event. I mean, come on. It couldn't be a better segue.
That's true.
I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. But,
No, I mean, people were talking about this, right? Like, some of these people were extras in White Noise, weren't they? Like, right before this happened.
Is that true?
I think in East Palestine.
I mean, I'm not surprised. The world works in very strange ways. I mean, dioxin, you know, that's just one small baby statistic. And, you know, dioxin, it's been found in products like tampons, diapers, coffee filters, tissues, lobsters, baby food, fertilizer, fuel. It's a byproduct to every book, magazine, document we read, except for my book, because I used chlorine-free paper in my book. And every piece of paper my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather ever made. So, you know, look around the room you're sitting in, everybody listening, or all those books behind all of us. there's only one other book I know that was published on chlorine-free paper, and it's called Pandora's Poison, and it's about chlorine and organochlorines. He was smart enough, like after researching for whatever, how many years, he published his book on that paper.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back.
So we spent some time on the EPA site devoted to the East Palestine derailment. And there's like a really complicated structure here because, as I understand it, the EPA ordered Norfolk Southern to clean up the site. And they're doing soil samples and air quality samples. But there's like a little bit like, who is doing those soil samples and air quality samples? Like, who is doing the testing? What are their thresholds? And but even so, this seems different, very different from the scene you describe in your book where mill employees, like often on their deathbeds after contracting cancer, admit to disposing of mill waste in unsafe ways or allowing untreated river water to, say, enter the town's drinking water in the direction of other mill employees. Nobody seems to be watching them. And the EPA has been criticized, and other actors in this whole situation, as you rightly point out, have been criticized for the response in East Palestine. But is the EPA's response here better, or is all of this data collection kind of still a cover-up?
I mean, data collection, I don't know. The data is just data. It's data. Data never changes anyone's minds, as far as I'm concerned. That's a whole other story. But, you know, I don't know who's doing the data collection there, and I should look that up a little more. But many studies, as you may know, are done by the companies themselves. Like the TRI database is called the Toxic Release Inventory. It's like a federally program where companies have to record what kind of toxics they're spewing into the air. But the companies do it themselves, and it's not monitored. So like, right, they can put whatever they want on there. You know, and there was an article published today in the New York Times by Eric Lipton, I think. And he said, an analysis prepared by the advocacy group Earth Justice based on federal records shows that more than 1 million pounds of so-called high priority chemicals, including carcinogens, butadiene, and formaldehyde, have been released over the past decade in the Deer Park neighborhood. Now, he's talking about Houston, but Houston and Palestine are actually connected. I don't know if you know that, but the Rebecca Altman has an incredible article called On Vinyl about this. It's just published online in Rye Magazine that connects those two places. But it was interesting because 1 million pounds, and we're talking about data, right? And I thought, huh, in my town, this is over 10 years, 1 million pounds of, it sounds terrible, right? In my town, in 2018, 2,421,017 pounds of toxic were released. Those are the ones that were reported into my town in 1 year. So like, I don't know, what is this data doing? Is anybody changing their mind about it? It sounds horrible. We all gasp and then everybody moves on because we're not dealing with people. We're dealing with data. They want to get the data down. They want to track the data. What about the people? Like, why aren't they doing something there? Why don't they just stop?
When you say 1 million pounds, you mean into the air? Or in some other way?
Yeah, I think he says more than 1 million pounds were released over the past decade. So that could mean air, soil, groundwater, whatever. Okay. Probably a combination of all those three, yeah.
There was a quote in that same article, which I read this morning as well, thinking that it was good timing for our discussion, that a person from that Texas Environmental Justice Advocacy Services calls these neighborhoods, like your town, sacrifice zones. I think seems like an apt term, like basically, okay, yes, we know the people are being poisoned there, but we have to do this industrial work. And so they're going to die.
Yeah, that's basically it. And it happens all over the world. And it happens even more egregiously in countries not our own, if you can imagine, right? People that have a lot less regulations than the EPA does. So it's frightening. And we're talking about one chemical right now, mainly dioxin. You know, we're not talking about what the sort of stew of chemicals can do to people or communities, like benzene, butadiene, mercury, all these things that are involved with a lot of these chemical processes. You know, scientists only study one at a time. They don't study what everything does to us. That's why we're like up the year with stuff. Sorry.
No, it's like, I'm like, I could ask you another question. I could just sit here stunned. And yet it's also right. Like, you're right. It's, these are specifics for things that in a broad sense, I know. Right. And so early in your book, Doc Martin, who we talked about earlier, receives a report showing that the area is having this unusual increase in cancer rates, and the board at the Rumsford Hospital near your hometown ignores it. And, you know, you're talking about there's no economic incentive in these cases now, right? The sacrifice zones. And, you know, back then, there's no economic incentive to regulate the mill. The town needs the money and the jobs. And these train derailments seem in so many ways like the same thing. The railroads know that there are things they could do to prevent the derailments. They could install better brakes. They could have more thorough inspections. And railroad unions have even called for some of these things, have been calling for those things for years. But if the fixes are expensive and the government doesn't require them, then the railroads don't take action. So back to the deregulation thing. Then I was also just reading about the fact that more and more of these chemicals for the manufacture of plastic are being transported across the U.S. because oil companies are sort of trying to shift to the manufacture of plastic because they're worried about decreasing reliance on fossil fuels. So can you talk a little bit more about to what extent these are stories, these environmental stories are stories about government regulation or the lack of it? Like, is that the problem?
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, no economic incentive. In fact, there was one headline when I was researching my book, they were like, mill pollution load increases, senators or congresspeople or whatever are not worried. Like, it was a thing because they want to promote manufacturing. And if you look at that newspaper article today, he's got Biden's sort of policy, environmental policy on there. And one of the things was like, increase local manufacturing. And I thought, that's an environmental policy? It seems like an anti-environmental policy. Until you put better restrictions on such companies. Like, for instance, with my paper, this is a perfect example going back to what you said. My book, I use this non-chlorinated paper. And we had to get it in Canada because my publisher looked and looked and looked and couldn't find any. So I asked Mills, why don't you produce this paper? He said, because nobody demands it. So this is part of us too. We need to make better demands upon our legislatures, upon these companies, make the demands. Because if we demanded this kind of paper, they would make it. But otherwise, they're not just going to stop and quit because these people have lives to also live. Like, we're all making compromises here and there. That's why I think blaming one or the other person or company or organization is not useful. We all have to like think about this together and like how we can stop this madness.
I mean, that's where I feel uneasy because when I look at the EPA site for East Palestine, I think nowhere in here is it saying if what they're doing is working. It's a lot of busy. I feel very gaslit. On the other hand, I don't want there to not be an EPA, which some people, which the Republicans would prefer to just get rid of it. And there was a Supreme Court case where they were at least considering like sort of removing the EPA's ability to regulate things, right? And so I want to be able to be critical of it without having people say that the criticism means it should disappear, because that would be worse.
I mean, here's what they should do, is they should pump a lot more money into it. It's understaffed, it's underfunded. And so, like, instead of Biden going to visit, Palestine, which is just an optic, really, right? Take all that money you're going to spend on Secret Service and your private plane and all this other crap and, like, give it to the EPA to do actual studies or to hire people or to give them, whatever. Like, pump money into the EPA so they can do their job. Right now, they can't monitor stuff because they don't have the people to do it. That's really what it boils down to. And the EPA has had a lot of their power taken away by the state too. And that's because of regulation, not because of Congress. There's a lot of stuff the state can regulate, and that all goes to politics,
Yeah. I was reading about like the layers of response here and the sort of responsibility football going on, right? That there's all this deference to the states, but actually, like, does the Ohio EPA have that much expertise? And then if you read the documents that are on the EPA website, where it's sort of like, oh, the EPA has taken control of the cleanup. It's like, no, they issued an order. they issued an order, and then they said, if you don't do it the way that we want you to, we'll charge you 3 times the price. And so this sounds very draconian, but if you actually, like, if you read a newspaper article about this situation, many of which are written really well and present the situation, it seems to me, fairly clearly, and then you look at the EPA site, the EPA site is like obfuscation.gov.
It is. Yeah. I think part totally of it is fucked. On it. Yeah, it's totally fucked. And I, you know, I spend a lot of time on the EPA's website. It's perennially infuriating. Like, I can't find anything that I want to find. And but again, I think it's lack of funding. Like, the people that work there, my husband's a bureaucrat. He worked in the U.S. Coast Guard for decades, and he still works for the Coast Guard. And a lot of these people are, they're not there to do bad things. They want to do good things. I've met a lot of them. But, like, if you're sort of handcuffed by time, money, and desire of our government, what can you do? You can only just kind of grab the, you know, what's that term? Just grab the
low-hanging fruit.
I was like, apple. What am I talking about? Low hanging fruit.
That has dioxin in it. Gary, thank you so much for joining us. And we encourage our readers to go pick up Milltown, Reckoning with What Remains, which is out now.
Thank you so much. And I'm sorry for being such a negative Nelly.
No, I think this is important stuff. And we really appreciate your taking the time to join us.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel, and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!